Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a federal judge today temporarily blocking the Trump administration from denying asylum to immigrants who cross the border at places not designated as official points of entry into the United States. Lee Gallant, the deputy director of the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project, who successfully argued the case for the ACLU on behalf of the immigrants before U.S. District Judge John Tegar in San Francisco, joins us to discuss the fate of the 70,000 people per year who claim asylum after crossing the border illegally. In addition, we will assess the chances of the migrants from Central America heading north through Mexico gaining entry, even if they show up at the 48 designated points of entry. And with 3,000 Central Americans from the caravans having arrived already in Tijuana, we will assess how long the migrants will have to wait in an increasingly inhospitable border town, given the long backlog, and how much Trump's order to deny migrants the right to apply for asylum based on the manner of their entry places people's lives in danger. And what happens to those who are denied asylum, since most of the migrants are refugees from Central America escaping gang violence and corrupt governments in collusion with narco traffickers? Then we'll examine the plunge in the stock markets as tech stocks take a beating, with five tech giants, Facebook, Amazon, Alphabet, Apple, and Netflix, losing more than $800 billion in market value since August. And speak with Dean Baker, senior economist and the co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press. He joins us to discuss the president's bizarre explanation for the stock market's decline, which Trump blames on Democrats, tweeting, quote, "The prospect of presidential harassment by the Dems is causing the stock market big headaches." We will look into recent concerns that Trump's trade policies and Federal Reserve tightening, along with a global slowdown which is now reaching the U.S., are the real problems. Then finally, we'll go to London to speak with Bill Browder, who was the largest foreign investor in Russia until he fell afoul of Putin, about the very real possibility that a Putin crony, Alexander Prokopyukov, could be voted in tomorrow by the 192 member countries of Interpol as the International Policy Agency's police agency's new head, with Putin having already tried seven times through Prokopyukov to have Browder arrested and extradited to Russia, a country in which the police do not fight organized crime but rather collude and cooperate with it. The prospect of a representative of the criminal regime being the world's policeman is indeed Kafkaesque. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who have been helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors, so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Lee Gallant, who is the deputy director of the ACLU's National Immigrants' Rights Project and the lead attorney on the ACLU's family separation case, Ms. L. versus ICE. He has been an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union since 1992, where his main focus is immigration and national security issues, and he's the professor at Columbia Law School. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lee Gallant.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Lee. It's been a long and busy day for you, and I'm glad that you can join us in successfully arguing the case before the district judge in San Francisco. What is the next stage here? I believe the ruling, the temporary stay goes to what, December the 15th, is it? December the 19th, right?
December 19th, the judge wants us back in court for a preliminary injunction hearing at that time, unless the parties agree to extend it. And at that point, we would have a hearing to decide whether the injunction would be extended. I suspect at that point, either side would appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals. The losing side would appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals, given the stakes.
Well, it seems that the Trump administration think that this is a temporary setback for them, and they've alluded to the 5-4 decision by the Supreme Court in June that upheld Trump's travel ban. Do you think their optimism is misplaced?
Well, we believe that there are very strong arguments on our side. And, I think to the extent that they are saying this is no different than the Hawaii v. Trump travel ban case, I think that's wrong. The difference here is that in this case, Congress has spoken directly to this question and has said in no uncertain terms, you may apply for asylum regardless of where you enter the country. And that's what's different about this case than the travel ban case. In the travel ban case, the government took pains to say that the president's travel ban did not conflict with any specific statutory provision that Congress had enacted. The Supreme Court decided that that was correct, that it did not, the travel ban in that case did not conflict with any provisions Congress had enacted, but made also clear that they assumed it would be a very different case if what the president was doing conflicted with what Congress wanted, and that Congress had enacted something specific and the president was trying to override it. Well, that's the case here. Congress has spoken to this issue, has decided that you have to be able to apply for asylum regardless of where you enter. The president has now come in with the attorney general and said, we don't care what Congress has said, we're going to override that. So we believe that this is very different than what the Supreme Court looked at in the travel ban, and we believe our arguments are very strong. What will ultimately happen in the courts remains to be seen.
And, of course, the judge in this case said whatever the scope of the president's authority, he may not rewrite the immigration laws to impose a condition that Congress has expressly forbidden. So what is the fate then, legal aunt, of all of these people? Because clearly what's going on here is that the Trump administration is just trying to find ways to stop people crossing the borders in general. And once you have a huge backlog at these entry points, these designated entry points already, as I mentioned in the opening, there's a lot of people in Tijuana waiting, and their fate is not entirely, or their security is not entirely guaranteed there. There have been some local protests against people. There are also some local people in Tijuana who are being very hospitable. So what is the strategy, do you think? Because it seems to me that all of these immigration policies are basically being directed or engineered by Stephen Miller and others in the White House who have an extremely hardline view, and they will do anything they can to skirt the law to get their way. So I take it from your point of view, you're engaged in a constant battle.
Well, I think you bring up an important point about what's happening at the ports of entry, and it's something the judge zeroed in on at the hearing yesterday, that what the administration is saying is, well, sure, just go to a port of entry and apply for asylum legally. It's no problem to do that. Well, what I said at the hearing was that there were two responses. One is the legal response. Congress said you don't have to go to a port of entry to apply for asylum. The second point is factual, and it's what you alluded to, is that at the ports of entry, the administration is simply not putting enough resources there. So the lines are now 4, 6 weeks, 8 weeks to be able to apply for asylum at a port of entry. You have families who cannot line up for 4 to 6 weeks. They're with little kids. It's very dangerous in the areas that they have to line up. And sometimes they're sleeping outside or they're sleeping in shelters that are extremely dangerous. They're being preyed upon by cartels. And the administration is also closing ports of entry. Sometimes a family is told, you can't apply to this port of entry, but there's one 50 miles away if you want to walk there. So, or the administration is pushing people back and saying, you can't come here and apply at a port of entry, or the Mexican government is not allowing them to apply at a port of entry. So this whole notion that it's very simple to go to a port of entry is wrong. And the other thing is you often have a lot of people from other countries that are unsophisticated, and they don't know where the port of entry is. And that's why Congress made the decision, look, we're not telling you you can come between a port of entry, but if you end up coming between a port of entry, you have to be able to apply for asylum, because asylum is special and fundamental, and we are not going to send people back to danger just because they applied in the wrong place. And that's what we're saying. We're not condoning people crossing between ports of entry. But what we are saying is if they happen to cross between a port of entry, they have to be allowed to apply for asylum. And I think the other point you hit on, which is also critical, is, and the judge also hit on it, is that what it looks like from everything the administration is saying, informally and officially, is they just don't want these people coming to apply for asylum. It's not really about whether they come to a port or in between ports of entry. They simply don't like this many people applying for asylum from the Northern Triangle. And that's a problem. You know, that's a real problem if the administration is taking that view, because this country has signed on to international treaties, and it's embedded in our domestic law that if you're fleeing persecution, you have to have an opportunity to apply for asylum. We should have learned our lesson after World War II in the 1950s that we simply can't turn people back if they're going to apply for asylum. Does everyone have a successful asylum claim? Of course not. But there are many people who are fleeing real danger and need to be given the chance to apply for asylum.
And again, I'm speaking with Lee Gallant, who is the Deputy Director of the ACLU's National Immigrants' Rights Project and the lead attorney on the ACLU's family separation case, Ms. L versus ICE. And he's been an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union since 1992, where his main focus is immigration and national security issues. And he's a professor at Columbia Law School. So if this is the intention to basically slow down the system, gum up the works, create these vast backlogs where you've got people living on the streets in Tijuana, falling prey to local criminals, et cetera, and then forcing them to go back home, the reason they've left in the first place is that they've taken this enormous risk, because life back home is untenable for them. Predatory drug gangs are trying to recruit their children. You either, you know, what do they say, you know, silver or lead, a bullet or a bribe. That's the sort of law of the jungle that they're escaping from. And then they take this hazardous trip through Mexico to get to the border, and then they have to wait around until they just get worn out. And what do they do? Do they go back? And I mean, they've got to be – they're pretty destitute to begin with. So it seems to me that if we're forcing these people to wear them out, essentially, and then what are their options to go back home? What's the position that the Mexican government's taking?
Right. Well, I think, you know, the Mexican government has not been a place generally where that's provided a safe third country. And until Mexico becomes a safe third country to these individuals, we have an obligation to provide a process for them to apply for asylum. But I think that's absolutely right that the administration is trying to wear them out. And it's also the administration is taking other steps to try and deter them from seeking asylum. One of the other things the ACLU was challenging is the Attorney General's decision to limit asylum for people fleeing gangs or domestic violence. That seems that it was specifically directed at many of the Central Americans who were fleeing gangs. So the administration is sort of attacking asylum on all fronts, and we are fighting to push back on all those fronts. But you're exactly right. They are trying to wear people out. They're trying to not let them seek asylum. And we simply, as the United States, should not be doing this. The United States should be standing for something better and should be providing a process for asylum. When people say, well, not everyone has a successful asylum claim, that's true, of course, but it doesn't mean that there are not a lot of people who are in need of our protection.
Well, the judge more or less said that, did he not? He said the administration's rule would force people to choose between violence at the border, violence at home, or giving up a pathway to refugee status.
Right. And the judge pressed both sides very hard, but one of the things he pressed the government on is, Are you saying that there are no legitimate asylum claims? What are you practically trying to achieve here? Because the rule the government has announced of trying to channel people to ports of entry simply makes little sense, given that a lot of people cannot go to ports of entry. And so what the judge was very concerned about and pressed the government very hard is, isn't this going to result in people just simply being sent back to danger through no fault of their own?
So just to sort of wrap up here, the federal law says that all people on U.S. soil can apply for asylum no matter how they arrived. That's the existing law, right?
Exactly. Congress enacted that in 1980 and then said it again in 1997, added additional language. And what it says now is you may apply for asylum, quote unquote, whether or not you act at a port of entry. As the judge found, the law could not be clearer. And the administration is simply trying to say, we don't care what Congress has said, we want to override it. And that's why the importance of this case is not just on a humanitarian level, but also a separation of powers level. It's the administration trying to override Congress and the judiciary coming in correctly and saying the president cannot override Congress's decision to provide a meaningful process for individuals seeking refuge here.
So does this mean then that Congress should step up and assert its separation of powers rights? That has not been happening of late with the Republican Congress.
No, it hasn't. And so I think that's why it's fallen on the judiciary to step up. Fortunately, in this case, Congress has spoken directly to the issue. So the courts can simply say, we're going to enforce Congress's will. Would it be helpful if Congress stepped up and said, we want to reaffirm it again? Absolutely. But there's enough on the books that Congress has done, at least prior Congresses, that the courts can enforce that without Congress doing anything more.
Well, just finally, though, Legoland, with this acting attorney general, who many consider not to be a constitutional appointment, is he going to stand up for the judiciary?
Well, I think it's right now, it's the attorney general's regulation that we're challenging a law, you know, and so I don't see the attorney general and the administration coming to these people's rescue because they're the ones who are the defendants in the case.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have to see what happens. I think in other fronts, people are now challenging his legitimacy, and so we'll see how that plays out as well.
Well, Legoland, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Lee Gallant, who's the Deputy Director of the ACLU's National Immigrants' Rights Project and the lead attorney on the ACLU's family separation case, Ms. L. versus ICE. He has been an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union since 1992, where his main focus is immigration and national security issues, and he's a professor at Columbia Law School. And we're going to take a brief station break and back examining the plunge in the stock markets as tech stocks take a beating.
Time to send someone away. Got my back covered. Said how you been all led astray. Come, let's count. It's absurd. They lead you to the race where no one's asked them to.
Get from out the road when he get dough, it's horrible. Time is money, spend, waste, save, invest, a fest. The 10K cave a chicken chest, S. Yes, y'all are dumb and get your trickles. The best ballers pitch in and rub to get a nickels. But tut tut, he bout to change the price again. It go up each time, he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, albums shrilling in fear. It won't stop, top ill until he a gazillionaire. Villain, his agenda is clear. Ending this year with dividends to spear. Here, a new meaning to sales through the roof.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org And joining us now is Dean Baker, a senior economist and co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He's the author of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, Rigged, How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he writes a popular economics blog, Beat the Press. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Well, thanks, Dean. And what do you make of the fact that the five tech giants, Facebook, Amazon, Alphabet, Apple, and Netflix, have lost more than $800 billion in market value since the end of August?
Well, it does a lot to address inequality and wealth. And I say that only half in jest. I mean, the stock market is basically where rich people have their money. So if people are concerned about inequality and wealth, they should be applauding a decline in the stock market. But realistically, these stocks are very, very high. You look at a company like Amazon, which had crossed $1 trillion in market valuation earlier in the year, and its profits were somewhere around $10 billion a year. That's a price-to-earnings ratio of 100 to 1. That's the sort of thing that may make sense for some new growth company that just, you know, small startup. But for, at this point, a pretty well-established company that have a price-to-earnings ratio of 100 to 1, it's pretty hard to see how that makes sense. So I think part of the story here is a little bit of reality sinking in. But part of it, we see that markets across the world are down. So it's not just the U.S. In fact, the U.S. market's done better this year than pretty much anyone else. And I think the basic story was the market had gotten very high. And, you know, there's nothing to justify that. You know, so it's not as though we expect to see some huge surge in growth. We had good growth the second quarter, third quarter, but most estimates are fourth quarter is going to be lower, and it's going to slow down into 2019. So, you know, in terms of where profits are going to be, it's hard to see. I think we've already hit their peaks, and I think investors are probably catching up a little bit with reality.
Well, a lot of these big tech giants have enormous market valuation, but they don't make profits.
That's right. I mean, Apple's the exception. Apple does make a lot of profits, but the others, you know, have market caps that are just way out of line with, you know, what would be a reasonable estimate given what their profits are. And again, if these were startups, if the, you know, we're going back 20 years and we're to the early years of Google and Amazon, that might be fine to have price-to-earnings ratios like this. But given that, you know, these are now well-established companies, it's very hard to tell a story. I'm picking on Amazon because they have looked at that a little bit. It's very hard to tell a story how that company is going to have profits to justify anything like its current market cap.
Well, it's one person who's figured out what's going on, and that is the President of the United States, who tweeted out that the prospect of presidential harassment by the Dems is causing the stock market big headaches. So President Trump seems to think that the reason the stock market is plunging is because the Democrats are going to be taking over in January. I take it you're not convinced by that.
Yeah. I don't know that he's convinced, but who knows? I mean, I was speculating what Donald Trump actually thinks is kind of a fool's game. But, yeah, the markets, first off, the market plunge started, you know, back in the summer. And, you know, I guess you could say, well, they first started to think the Democrats could win. But I think, you know, people followed the polls closely. And certainly if you have a lot of money in the stock market and you think that it's going to make a big difference, you're going to follow the polls closely. The fact that the Democrats were likely to win, that's been true for months. You know, I mean, that goes back to the spring. So none of this is really a surprise. So that really doesn't fit, nor does it fit the fall off in Europe. I mean, do we think that stocks are down in Germany because investors are worried that Donald Trump's going to face more questions and he's actually going to have to be accountable? I mean, that's a little hard to imagine. I mean, so anyhow, no, it's very, very hard to see a story where that could fit. I mean, the only remotely plausible story where something like what Trump's saying can make sense is that if there was a hope that they would get still further corporate tax cuts, that obviously is going to be less likely with the Democrats in holding the House of Representatives. But I doubt too many people have much hope of further tax cuts given how much they'd already gotten.
And again, I'm speaking with Dean Baker, the senior economist and co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He's the author of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, and Rigged, How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he writes a popular economics blog, Beat the Press. So let's talk about what's really causing the stock market headaches. And my understanding is that the real concerns are about Trump's trade war and trade policies getting out of hand and the Federal Reserve tightening, along with a global slowdown, as you've mentioned, starting in Europe, which is, if it hasn't already reached the U.S., it eventually will. So are they the real problems?
Yeah, I mean, well, 2 points. I mean, first off, as I was saying, I think the market was very high. So some come down doesn't necessarily mean, you know, that they suddenly got wind of bad news. It's just like it was at a high level, then it was, you know, people got wise to reality, that sort of thing. But, yeah, I mean, if you look at the news, are things going to be better for companies 6 months out, a year out than they are today? Most things point to them being worse. You'd mentioned the Fed interest rates have been rising. I'm not happy about that. I mean, I think the Fed's gone too quickly in raising interest rates, and maybe they'll slow down. But nonetheless, I don't think anyone disputes interest rates are going to be higher 6 months out than they are today. So that's bad news for the economy. We're seeing that very clearly in housing. So it might show up in other sectors, but in any case, very clearly in housing. The slowdown in Europe, Europe's economies, Germany actually had a quarter negative growth. That was largely a fluke, but nonetheless, there's nowhere in Europe that's really going very strongly. The uncertainty over Brexit certainly doesn't help. Japan had a negative quarter growth, again, largely a fluke, but it's not growing strongly. So the rest of the world economy doesn't look good. And the trade war with China, I mean, people could exaggerate, but I think the basic story there is Trump doesn't seem to know what he's doing. And there have been some pieces, obviously based on leaks, where his negotiators thought they had deals with China, and then they come back and Trump starts yelling at them, saying, no, we can't agree to that. So you could envision a lot of issues with China and, you know, some tariffs, this and that. But the question is, okay, so you do that, and then after 6 months, after a year, do you settle down and go back to something like what we had? Or do you just keep fighting? And Trump doesn't seem to know what he wants to do. So that's a scenario that understandably would get businesses upset, because they don't know what the world's going to look like in terms of our trade with China a year, two, 3 years out.
Well, is there problems, though, in China that are sort of a little bit below the surface? We, you know, we've gotten used to the idea of talking about the Chinese miracle and how fast that economy has grown. But my understanding, there's some really serious structural problems in China. They basically had to close down their stock market because of, you know, it's essentially become a gambling casino. There's apparently massive amounts of municipal debt. So as bad as things are here, is it possible that there are other shoes to drop around the world, in China and in India and some of these other economies, that could eventually impact our economy? You're talking about the slowdown in Europe, you know, eventually impacting us. But could there be some real reversals in China and other countries?
Well, a couple things with China. First off, I've been hearing people give doom and gloom stories about China for more than two decades. And all I could say, I certainly will not claim expertise in China, but just we haven't seen it. So you go, at some point, you sort of have to give them credit. At least I'm inclined to give them credit and think that, okay, they're likely going to be able to find a way to paper things over, which, you know, is what they've done. And in principle, you could do that pretty much indefinitely if you're a country like China, big country, prints its own currency, has massive reserves, you know, foreign exchange reserves, dollars and other assets. So I'm not too concerned China's about to collapse. The other point in terms of the U.S. economy, we actually don't sell them that much. So, you know, that would be a negative. You know, if you envision its economy still growing 6 to 7% a year, so let's say it actually stops growing for a year or two, that hurts our economy. It doesn't devastate it. We just don't export that much to them. So that's hard to see. again, India, similar story. We don't export that much to them. I know less about India's economy than China's. And again, they've managed to maintain strong growth for two decades. Will they continue to? Can't say, but I'd be a little skeptical of those who have a gloom and doom scenario on India. Again, the wealthier countries that we do a lot of trade with, they look weak but not collapsing. Now, one exception that I do wonder about, Canada, of course, which we have a great deal of trade with, they are seeing falls in their housing market. They have very overpriced housing. So there we may be seeing the collapse of a housing bubble. Australia, too. We do less trade with Australia, but a similar sort of story. Both of them have house prices well above the U.S. They're both somewhat poorer. I'm not going to say hugely poor, but they are somewhat poorer as countries in the U.S. So it's a little perverse that their house prices are higher, about 50% higher in both or 30% higher in both cases. And neither Australia or Canada are countries we think of as having land shortages that might justify extraordinarily high house prices.
Well, I think in both Australia and Canada, one of the things that's driving up house prices are wealthy Chinese parking their money abroad.
That's a factor. In certain areas, Vancouver, that probably is a big issue. It's hard to see that for the whole country. That's an awful lot of money to be parked from abroad. And even then, the point is you can build more houses. And, of course, they have been building more houses. So, again, that's where the land constraint gets to be an issue. In UK, which also has very high house prices, there you could more readily say that, okay, it's a densely populated country, limited area where you could build land. Not true in Canada, not true in Australia. So I do think they may be taking a hit in their housing market, which will have a larger impact on their economy. And then, of course, a spillover to the U.S. None of this gives us a U.S. recession, but again, a drag on growth.
Well, I think a real factor is, and Dean Baker, you've pretty much shot down the idea that there are troubles abroad. The real problems may well be here at home with just simply a lack of leadership, somebody that doesn't know what they're doing. And, one of the things we've learned about since Trump's become president is how powerful the executive branch is. And when you've got a bull in a china shop, somebody that doesn't know what they're doing but obviously enjoys the levers of power. We're going through a kind of period in this country like ancient Rome with Nero. I mean, I think the comparison between Trump and, as you point out, his advisors, and some of them are really dreadful, like Peter Navarro. If they go over there and try and, settle these trade disputes and tariff wars, and then they think they've got a deal and come back, then Trump has a tantrum. I don't think the contrast could be greater between the Chinese, who have a planned economy and pretty smart people seem to be running it, compared to what we have here, which is pure chaos.
Yeah, it's not a good way to run an economy. I mean, there's no doubt about it. The only thing I could say is, I shouldn't say there's only so much he could mess up. There's only so much he's likely to mess up in a relatively short period of time. But on the other hand, with the levers of power, he can do a lot of things, be very perverse, that would cause a lot of damage. Again, you sort of hope he won't do it. I mean, this is one of the things, we should all be very thankful that the Democrats retook Congress, because there is someone to have a check on it. Because, basically the Republicans' attitude was, we don't care, give us tax cuts, and anything else, nothing else mattered. So there is somewhat of a check, but sure, I mean, he certainly could go off the deep end. So the fact that we don't have a deal with China on trade, that's unfortunate. It's not a disaster. Now, if he keeps ramping up tariffs and does them in a haphazard way and no one expects them and he changes them arbitrarily, which he might, that does make it a very difficult environment for businesses to plan in.
So just to touch on another one of Trump's remarks about the, of course, he blamed the stock market decline on the Democrats. But the other thing he's blamed previously was he blamed the Federal Reserve for stock markets declines, complaining that the central bank had raised its benchmark rates three times this year. And in an interview last month in the Wall Street Journal, he said that maybe he regretted appointing the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell. So what's going on there with, you know, the getting rid of quantitative easing? What are the – I mean, isn't that what's happening a kind of natural consequence? Or do you think there is anything to Trump's complaints about the Federal Reserve?
Well, there is. I mean, the Fed has been raising rates. They've been relatively modest in the pace at which they're doing it, but they are raising rates, and that has had an impact in terms of longer-term interest rates. So if you look at the 30-year mortgage, it had been around 3.9 a year ago, or last summer, I should say, maybe a little more than a year ago. Currently, it's flirting with 5. And that has a big impact on the housing market. It makes it more expensive for people to buy a house, refinance. Refinancing has gone through the floor. That was a major source of money for people. A lot of people had mortgages at higher interest rates. They refinance at a lower one and frees up money to pay bills or to buy things. You know, so that was a spur to the economy. So the Fed's been raising rates, and it definitely slows the economy. Now, their argument is they're doing that to prevent inflation, and with Trump having a big tax cut, that definitely gave a boost to growth. I mean, he's boasting about that. That's right. But that also puts more pressure on the labor market, brings us to a more inflationary environment. Now, to my view, I would like to see the Fed, you know, hold back. I wish they would, you know, let's see how tight we got the unemployment rate down to 3.7. Can we get down to 3.3? Can we get down to 3? Let's see, because there's enormous benefits to the labor market, particularly the most disadvantaged workers, workers with less education, workers who are discriminated against, African Americans, Hispanics, workers who have criminal records. So I wish the Fed would hold off. On the other hand, for Trump to be surprised, you sort of go, you're supposed to be this astute businessman. None of this was a surprise. If anything, the Fed has been more cautious than sort of what the consensus estimate of Fed watchers would have been in raising rates. So he's talking like they're just doing it out of the blue. I remember he was calling Powell or the Fed crazy. And you go, look, I disagree with them too, but this was 100% telegraphed. And for better or worse, that's very much the mainstream position in economics. So I share his concern that the Fed might be going too far, but they aren't coming out of left field with this. This is very much, you know, been telegraphed by them and very much the consensus within the economics profession.
So, again, you just get back to this extraordinary situation that the head of state doesn't know what he's doing.
It's very disconcerting. I mean, one of the things, you know, I and others have been working, you know, trying to pressure the Fed to be loose on interest rates. One of the people he nominated, Marvin Goodfriend, he still hasn't been approved by the Senate because there's unanimous opposition from the Democrats, and Rand Paul had also been opposed to him, so it's not clear they can get him through. But he's been a big inflation hawk. He's been wanting to raise interest rates since 2010. So here you are, if you're Donald Trump and you're upset that Jay Powell is raising interest rates, why did you just pick a guy who'd been, if he had his druthers, you know, the interest rates would be twice as high today?
Well, again, it is an amazing situation to have this clown at the helm of the ship of state. It's just surreal. The only analogy I can come up with is Nero in ancient Rome. You know, fasten your seatbelts and enjoy your Thanksgiving, Dean Baker.
Well, you have a good Thanksgiving, too. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who's a senior economist and co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He's the author of Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press. We're going to take a brief station break, back looking into how the prospect of tomorrow's vote to find out who the new head of Interpol will be could end up with a representative of Putin's criminal regime being the world's policeman.
It's the money. was not a crime. In jail time, in jail time, in jail time, it was not a crime.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from London is Bill Browder, the chief executive and founder of Hermitage Capital Markets. He was the largest foreign investor in Russia until he was suddenly denied entry to the country and declared a threat to national security by the Russian government for exposing corruption. And since 2009, when his lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, died in a Russian prison after uncovering a $230 million fraud committed by Russian government officials, Bill has been leading a global campaign to expose the corruption and human rights abuses endemic in Russia. And as a result of this campaign, the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act was signed into U.S. law in 2012, imposing visa bans and asset freezes on certain officials involved in Magnitsky's death. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Browder.
Great to be here.
Well, thank you, Bill. And it looks as though tomorrow, Wednesday, Interpol may vote to put in charge of the international police force based in Lyon, France, Alexander Propopchuk, who is an official with the Interior Ministry. And this is an extraordinary turn of events because you yourself were arrested by Interpol on a bogus Russian charge in Spain. And I think Moscow has gone after you on seven separate occasions to try and bring you to Russia. So with a Russian tied to Putin in charge of Interpol, that's worse than putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank.
Well, there's one added element to the horribleness of it, which is that this guy Kaputsik was the person in charge of the Russian operation to get me back to Russia on these bogus Interpol arrest warrants. And so he was there. He's been there since 2011, and in every single one of their attempts to try to get me arrested, it was under his guidance that they were doing that. And so you don't just have a guy from a bad country doing this stuff. You got the bad guy who's now in line to be president of the International Police Organization. There couldn't be something more absurd than that. This guy should not be under consideration for this job under any circumstances.
Well, a number of U.S. senators have written a letter complaining about this possible choice, and I believe tomorrow, as I mentioned, 192 member countries of Interpol are due to vote. What kind of sway do you think U.S. senators will have on trying to block this appointment?
Well, I'm 100% sure that the U.S. Department of Justice, who is the organization that will be voting, will vote for the alternative candidate, who is a South Korean without any of this terrible criminal baggage. But the problem with this, as you mentioned, is 192 members, and each country has an equal vote. And so the United States has a vote that's equal to the vote of Cameroon. Britain has a vote that's equal to the vote of Tajikistan. And Russia can go around and do all of their dirty tricks like they did when they were trying to get the World Cup or the Olympics, where they're going around and find little countries where they can do all sorts of stuff and nobody's going to care. And I would be very surprised if they weren't doing that here in terms of getting all sorts of dodgy countries supporting them.
Well, is it clear to a majority of the member countries of Interpol that Russia is a country where the police don't fight organized crime? They cooperate and collude with organized crime.
They don't just cooperate and collude. They are the organized criminals. This is the big thing that almost nobody sees, is that government and organized crime is one and the same. You basically have guys in the government who are making decisions about interest rates in one meeting, and then they're making decisions about who to assassinate in the next meeting. That's the kind of guys you have Russia running the Russian government. And unfortunately, as far as the question goes, you've got some people that aren't sensitized to this. I mean, most of the world, most countries in the world are not democracies. They don't have a rule of law, and they don't care one way or any the other about it. It's all transactional. And so it's actually, we're in the minority when we look at places like the United States, Western Europe, and Australia, and Japan, which are democracies with rule of law. That's not what goes on in most of the world. And so you've got people who don't care about this stuff, who are perfectly happy to scratch Russia's back or take some money or whatever it is that they're doing to get these votes.
Well, already the head of Interpol, the former head of Interpol, was arrested in China on a family visit, and that's all rather murky. And, of course, China is definitely a country where there's no rule of law, except for what Xi Jinping decides is the law, not unlike Russia itself. So does that mean that if Prokopchuk is voted in tomorrow to head up Interpol, you'll be number one on Interpol's hit list again, if not more endangered?
Well, in fact, yesterday the Russians announced new charges against me. They now accused me of killing Sergei Magnitsky. And so and doubling down on their efforts to have me arrested and so on. And so they've been after me. You know, I'm enemy number one over there, and surely they're going to take advantage of whatever new power they have. I can only hope that the other members of Interpol who are funding Interpol to a greater or lesser extent, the United States and the EU, will use that financial leverage to try to put some controls in place, because this could get very ugly very quickly.
Did you say that they've charged you with murdering your lawyer who was murdered in jail for exposing corruption?
I've just said that, indeed. That's what they said yesterday. They held a big press conference, and they accused me of murdering Sergei Magnitsky.
Well, there was a book written about Putin's Russia where nothing is true and everything is possible. But that takes the cake, surely.
Well, it particularly does, because for 9 years I've been fighting for justice for him, and the Russian government has refused to acknowledge that he was murdered. They said he had died of natural causes, even though we have evidence that he was beaten on the night he died, and we have pictures of his body all bruised in black and blue, and we have medical reports showing all the different things that happened to him, and they've been sort of stubbornly saying he wasn't murdered. Then all of a sudden, and I should point out that the timing of this was that today the European Union is discussing European Union Magnitsky Act, and Putin gets more and more bothered and more agitated, more and more countries do this, and so this seems to be their reaction to that, which is to throw this unbelievable, just like Kafka-esque accusation at me. But in a certain way, it also shows how rattled they are by everything that I'm doing.
And again, I'm speaking with Bill Browder, who's the chief executive and founder of Hermitage Capital Markets. He was the largest foreign investor in Russia until he suddenly denied entry to the country and declared a threat to national security by the Russian government for exposing corruption. And since 2009, when his lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, died in a Russian prison after uncovering a $230 million fraud committed by Russian government officials, Bill has been leading a global campaign to expose the corruption and human rights abuses endemic in Russia. And as a result of this campaign, the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act was signed into U.S. law in 2012, imposing visa bans and asset freezes on certain officials involved in Magnitsky's death. Well, but this is a country, Russia, where there have been some very, very high-profile assassinations. The journalist Anna Politkovskaya and, of course, the politician Boris Nemtsov killed right in front of the Kremlin. The authors of those murders have never been identified or arrested. And then, of course, you've got Litvinenko's poisoning with polonium in the UK, and the author of that, instead of being punished, was given a medal by Putin. And, of course, they've identified GRU officers behind the poisoning of Sergei Skripal in Salisbury. So this is an amazing, I guess, again, we're getting back into this Kafkaesque tableau of the absurdity of crime and punishment in Russia. And, of course, just recently, there were 400 kilograms of cocaine found in the Russian embassy building in Buenos Aires back in February. The drugs were due to be transported to Russia as a diplomatic cargo. So it does seem as if the entire government infrastructure of Russia is just riven with corruption.
It's the main purpose of the Russian government, which is to commit crimes. It's an organized criminal country. And Vladimir Putin is the mafia boss. And so, to then say that this country is going to be running the international police organization, it just beggars belief. It means that we basically all things as we know it aren't the same. And in a certain way, Putin wins either way. He wins with his guy getting there, or he wins with the fact that we've even considered it.
So here in the United States, of course, Tuesday, we're expecting the White House report on the Trump administration's response to the murder of the Washington Post columnist in Istanbul in the Saudi consulate, which the CIA is in a leak have suggested that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the assassination. President Trump is pretty much alone amongst world leaders and even Republican senators here in the United States in clinging to the defense of MBS. There is a lot of talk in the Congress of invoking the Sergei Magnitsky Global Act. So tell us about how the act was structured and how its reach can go beyond the initial murder of your lawyer. And obviously you were responsible for getting the act passed, but you mentioned a European version of it. So tell us about its foundation and its apparent ability to reach other bad actors.
Well, it was originally conceived to punish the people who weren't being the people who killed Sergei Magnitsky that weren't being punished in Russia. The two sponsors were late Senator John McCain and Senator Benjamin Cardin. And it started with one crime, and then it became obvious that there was a lot of other crimes in Russia, and so it was broadened to all gross human rights abusers in Russia. And after the Magnitsky Act was passed just for Russia back in 2012, the senators said, well, wait a second, this is such a powerful tool. Why don't we use it against bad guys everywhere? And in 2016, the Global Magnitsky Act was passed, and it's now been applied to either to 84 either people or companies that have been involved in human rights abuse and kleptocracy. And it's become an extremely powerful tool, and it doesn't just apply to Russia. It's been applied to Saudi Arabians and Venezuelans and Chinese and generals from Burma and Nicaragua. And it really is a very powerful tool, and it's now being emulated around the world. The Canadians have it. The Brits have it. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania has it. And as I mentioned, the EU is now actively considering it. And this is a really powerful tool, which goes right to the heart of what people do most of their killing over, which is stealing money. And people, it freezes their money and it bans their visas. And people don't like that. These powerful dictators who do this kind of stuff don't like their money frozen. It makes them feel powerless. And this is really a very tough tool, which now is becoming a viral, is going viral and becoming a tool to be applied all over the world to bad guys.
Well, President Trump has signaled that he won't punish the Saudi Crown Prince, and apparently the CIA briefing has not had the effect it's had on Senators Lindsey Graham and others on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee who want to proceed with the invoking the Sergei Magnitsky Global Act to sanction further or more Saudi officials. Apparently, General Assiri, the former Deputy Minister of Intelligence, is close to MBS. He wasn't on the original sanctions list, so we'll wait and see what happens. But it looks as though MBS is going to skate on this one, largely because President Trump is determined to protect him. And this, of course, raises lots of questions over here. But questions have been raised about President Trump and his peculiar relationship with Vladimir Putin for some time now. And this situation with Saudi Arabia appears to mirror that whatever the connections are, and obviously the special counsel Robert Mueller is looking into possible collusion between the Trump administration or the Trump campaign and Russia. What's your take on it, since you know Russia well and you're number one on Putin's hit list? What do you think is going on in terms of, I think the most telling aspect, as far as I can tell, is that under Obama, Obama's policy to punish Russia was based upon the idea that the real sanctions against Russia, the things that really work, since it's a resource-based economy exporting oil and gas, is if you lower the price of oil and gas, that really hurts Putin. And Obama was pretty effective at that, along with the fracking boom in shale oil production here in the United States. But ever since Trump has come into office, the price of oil has risen, and that has been a gift to Putin, and it's effectively saving him because apparently he steals as much as he can, him and the Siloviki and his cronies, but they have to throw a bone to the Russian people. So where do we stand in terms of the Russian economy being rescued by the rising price of oil?
Well, I think that it's, as you say, it's a very dependent country, very dependent on oil. But it's also, don't underestimate how hard these sanctions have been for Putin and the Russian oligarchs. This has been really tough on them. And I've read a report saying that the sanctions put in place have basically lopped 10% of the economy, 10% of GDP off of the economy. And so I think that that's really pretty strong, pretty powerful. And Putin is very much upset by this. And we shouldn't underestimate how important these sanctions are.
But it's true, surely, that the rising price of oil allows him to sort of placate the Russian people. Their pensions have been diluted. Their life expectancy is going down. It sounds like there was a while there where things were, when oil was really riding high, there was a kind of a trickle-down effect. But the level of looting that's going on is extraordinary, and I find it absolutely incomprehensible that the Russian people are so apparently servile in accepting that the cream of their economy is being raked off. I mean, there was a case recently where a Russian banker, an honest banker, exposed some money laundering going on via the Baltics into a Danish bank involving $200 billion allegedly stolen by Putin and his family. If that's just one part of the looting process, do you have any statistics, Bill Browder, on how much is siphoned off the Russian economy and stashed abroad on an annual basis?
Yeah, I would estimate that Putin and his cronies have stolen $1 trillion from the Russian economy and the Russian people over a 20-year period, $1 trillion. And so it's an unbelievable statistic. And it's, as you say, it's left most Russian people living a life of real destitute poverty. For 1,000 people who live in villas and sail around in yachts and fly around in private planes. But I wouldn't go so far as to say the Russian people are happy with it or accepting it. They're not. And people are grumbling and protesting and causing Putin all sorts of grief because it's hard to control a bunch of hungry, angry people. And that's his big challenge, is to try to, how do you keep 141 million Russians from overthrowing you? And that's what he's got to worry about every day.
And does that explain his kind of bread and circuses, foreign policy, creating little wars in Georgia, in Ukraine, Syria,
absolutely,
et cetera?
Absolutely. You create a foreign enemy, and then people don't get mad at you and get everyone all worked up against that foreign enemy. That's exactly what he's up to.
So, but can he keep that up? I mean, that act is getting a bit tired, isn't it?
It is indeed, and the Russians are not happy with it either. They're saying, okay, why are we doing all this stuff in Syria? Why don't we put some bread on the table, fill in that pothole on the road, give me some medicine? Mm. And that's his big challenge, and he's scared of his people.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Bill Browder.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Bill Browder, who is the chief executive and founder of Hermitage Capital Markets. He was the largest foreign investor in Russia until he was suddenly denied entry to the country and declared a threat to national security by the Russian government for exposing corruption. And since 2009, when his lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, died in a Russian prison after uncovering a $230 million fraud committed by Russian government officials, Bill has been leading a global campaign to expose the corruption and human rights abuses endemic in Russia. And as a result of this campaign, the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act was signed into U.S. law in 2012, imposing visa bans and asset freezes on certain officials involved in Magnitsky's death. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program's available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review it on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.